Thinking Too Hard About Anime, an episode-by-episode discussion of a beloved animated series. It's a little bit of history, a little bit of analysis, and a lot of over-examining the Japanese cartoons we love so much. I am your co-host, Noah Carden, and joining me, as always, is...
Aaron J. Shelton.
And today, we are going to be covering Cowboy Bebop Session 22, Cowboy Funk.
The synopsis for this episode is that the Teddy Bomber is trying, and honestly succeeding, to blow up a bunch of skyscrapers. But Spike isn't so much concerned with catching him as he is about besting the American Western-styled cowboy on horseback that hinders his attempts to catch the bounty, the cowboy Andy. And then it turns into like a Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck kind of thing.
Yeah. We'll talk about when we get to the end, the end scene, because that's definitely kind of, it's actually kind of stuck with me in a way. But yeah, this episode was directed by Kunihiro Mori and written by Keiko Nobumoto. It is actually one of the few episodes that was not played in the initial airing of the series in America, just due to the timing. Obviously, it deals with a lot of destroying high-rise buildings and things like that. So 9/11 had just happened a few months prior. So they didn't air it in the first run.
Because of this podcast, I have talked about 9/11 more than I have since it, like, happened. It's weird that it's so connected to this show here in the West.
Yeah, it's really just a matter of timing, honestly. Like, it is just the show started right before, and then it was, like, only like four episodes in to its initial run when 9/11 happened. And that just really kind of tied itself in to the show in a way. At least it's airing in America. Yeah, it is kind of crazy to think about it, how that is like weirdly linked to this show. So this episode introduces Andy, and he only ever really shows up in this episode. He does have one small cameo in the movie. Well, first of all, he looks an awful lot like Spike. And second, he's voiced in Japanese by Masashi Ibarra, who, for anybody who watches shows in Japanese, might recognize him as Might Guy from Naruto, who is Rock Lee's mentor.
Or not his dad, which is what I think Vince taught me that one. I'm like, yes. Oh, yeah, that's his dad. It's like, no, it's not. I'm like, but they're the exact same, though.
Yeah, no, Mike Guy is not Rock Lee's father. There's just a weird, like, mentor thing going on there. But he's also the official dub-over artist for Tom Hanks and Robin Williams.
You know what? I see it.
In English, he's portrayed by Darren Norris, who you might recognize, especially if you are a early 2000s kid, as the voice of Cosmo from the Fairly Odd Parents.
What?
Yeah.
That high-pitched squeak, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he does, in the Fairly Odd Parents, he does Cosmo, Jorgen von Strangel, Anti-Cosmo, and Mr. Turner, which I definitely think Mr. Turner, you can definitely hear it.
I will say that having watched the sub and the dub, the portrayal of Andy in the dub is so good and just perfect. I mean, part of it is just, I think it's easier for a native English speaker and a Westerner to dub over a cowboy.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's easier to draw from.
Yeah, definitely. He also played Cliff McCormack in the television series Veronica Mars. And a weird little... I wanted to call it goss, some
ooh,
gossip.
Okay,
but
I'm pouring some International's coffee. I'm ready to dish.
From 1988 to 2012, he was married to Mary Elizabeth McGlynn, who plays Julia in the show, and as of 2018, is now married to Steve Bloom, the voice of Spike.
Rivals till the end.
not to get into somebody's personal life, but I just thought that was kind of a weird little tidbit there.
I'm sure it's all amicable.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope so. This is also one of the episodes that I don't have a version of it in my book here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not seeing any in here that really line up with.
If we can get to the episode, kind of makes sense. So I think there's a lot more going on under the hood in this episode than we realize. Because on its surface, it's like, it's a goofy episode.
Oh, yeah.
But underneath, I can see how it wasn't planned beforehand, because it is a meta commentary on Spike and sort of his type of character.
Yeah.
And I think, again, the way animation is, it's not like the audience reacted to Spike and like, let's make this episode in response to audience reaction. I think they sort of knew internally. Because Spike on the surface is like, well, he's this very cool noir gangster, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He knows fucking Jeet Kune Do. He's a rad character. And they blow that all up and show him as like, show the more negative aspects of him through Andy.
Literally.
Yeah.
They literally blow it all up.
But it's no, Spike's hard-headed, stubborn.
Yes.
Has bad taste, and sort of saying, hey, you know, Spike is not a character you should emulate, right?
Yeah, he's a cool character, but he's also, like, exactly like you said, and like we've said a million times, I think, during our discussions of the show, is that he's very straightforward with his approach. If something doesn't work, he kicks it. You know, once he sets his sight on something, he tends to see it all the way through, be that for, you know, better or worse.
Yeah, and Andy, like you said before, just looks so much like Spike. It's essentially a palette swap.
Yeah, he's just blonde Spike, pretty much.
And I think towards the end of the episode, they start mirroring their movements. They're animated in such a similar way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, there's a great shot towards the end where they finally confront each other for the big fight at the end, and they're literally in the same pose, just mirrored, like the same jawline, the same like leg out, fist up sort of pose. And then they shout at like the Teddy Bomber, and they're like literally mirrored, like as they smash their faces together.
If not for the grace of God, go Spike, essentially. Like if he was on his own, grew up rich, this is totally what he would do. He'd be in a ship. He'd have bad taste in decorations. As Faye pointed out, and it's the idea that Spike thinks of himself as an original. Spike knows he's cool for like 100%. He tries to say cool things. He tries to act cool, and sort of presented with that mirror that is Andy, who Andy is trying to be cool.
Yes.
I dress up like a cowboy. I didn't do it. No one dresses up like a cowboy in space because they, if they don't think it's cool.
Yeah.
And the brazen attitude of Andy, I think at the very beginning, it's like, oh, I don't trust, you know, flat out saying like, oh, you can't trust faces nowadays. I just trust my instinct.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, Spike, that's you, you dumb idiot. And then the frustration of Spike having that idea of himself presented back to him and the frustration of it. I hate doing this, but it's the one example I can think of. But in the beginning of Fight Club, where Edward Norris is going to the different self-help groups to help him sleep, but you know, even though he's faking all these diseases, when he sees the character of Marla Singer, he gets frustrated and it doesn't work anymore because, well, they can't be a faker here. I'm a faker here.
Right.
It's that I've wrecked my brain trying to find other examples, but I feel like this is sort of the double, but that's not really a double character. Yeah. Is used in fiction. That's the one that I tried to think of, at least in an antagonistic sense. But yeah. We learn Spike that is, he's not as cool as he may think he is.
Yeah, exactly.
And then also, I mean, just you mentioned it before, but like this is some pre 9/11 stuff that you can have in a show.
Where, oh yeah,
because the Teddy Bomber blows up a bunch of buildings, and that aspect of the episode is backdrop. It's weirdly comedic. A bomber.
Yeah. The fact that he's like bombing buildings. He tries to bomb like the three tallest buildings in the city on Mars. And like he gets away with it for the most part. Like he wants to get out this message, and Spike and Andy's like rivalry with each other keeps getting in the way of that. Like the guy just wants to tell everybody why he's doing this, and he keeps getting shouted down because Andy and Spike want to fight each other. And the fact that he's using like teddy bears to literally blow up buildings. Like, I think the closest we ever get to them actually like playing the seriousness of what is happening is at the party when everybody else is trying to get out of the building. Like, they're all freaking out and behaving like what, you know, you kind of expect people in a building that's about to blow up would. But everything else is just, yeah, like, the first one, there's just like this kind of smooth scene between Spike and the Teddy Bomber on the escalator. And then there's the party scene, which just very rapidly gets out of hand. The man shows up on a horse in an elevator.
That is one tame horse.
Yes. Well, I mean, Onyx is great. Onyx can play chess, apparently. So. and then the last one, they blow up like the top of like a weird arcology pyramid thing that apparently is like City Hall or something like that.
Yeah, it's too big for City Hall.
But then like Spike and Andy like crawl up it like a couple of monkeys and like fight each other on top of it, because what else are they gonna do?
Well, yeah, Spike. I like that Jet was like, I forget in which version, it might have been both, but Jet comments like, yeah, Spike likes fighting in high places, was essentially what he was saying.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like, yeah, he does, doesn't he? Can't get enough of it.
Yeah, just seeing all that nowadays just feels really bizarre. I feel like, I don't know, like I'm trying to bring up Man of Steel, but I don't want to bring up Man of Steel.
I mean, I haven't watched it, so.
It's just like, you can tell that it's a movie made after 9/11 from the way that the destruction of buildings is portrayed. Like, they all have that sort of feel of September 11th. And watching this episode, it's like, yes, there's a lot of destruction, but it's not what we kind of know that kind of destruction to look like now.
It's, if we go back to something we talked about in a past episode, like Batman the Animated Series, there are bombs all over that cartoon.
Literally the opening of the show is a bomb blowing up a bank.
And I think that's it, right? It's explosions and bombs felt like something that only happened in fiction in a pre-9/11 world. Mm-hmm. Here in the West. And then after that, it's like, no, it became all too real. The idea of the suicide bomber.
Mm-hmm.
After that, dirty bombs and IEDs.
IEDs.
No, IED, yeah. IEDs are something else.
yes, IEDs are very different. Yeah.
One's very good, one's very bad.
Yeah, because I mean,
one should be free, the other one should not exist.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, even with stuff like Oklahoma City, it's a lot of that was like aftermath. I feel like there's not a lot of footage of it happening like with 9/11. Like, that was something that happened in like the biggest city in the world to a massive like cultural and architectural icon of the city. And a lot of it just straight up happened on TV. And I think that is definitely, you know, it is obviously like echoed throughout the rest of history, especially American cultural history and how we view stuff like that.
speaking to that point, again, sort of the flippant nature of this episode and this subject matter, I think it can be traced to sort of to the inspiration for the Teddy Bomber. So a thing I never thought I'd say in this podcast, let's talk about the Unabomber. I mean, you 90s kids will probably remember this gentleman, but the Unabomber was the nickname of one Ted Kaczynski. He was a mathematician, a Harvard alum, a professor at UCL Berkeley, who turned to being a domestic terrorist in between 1978 and 1995. Sent letter bombs to various universities and airports, unfortunately killing 3 people and injuring 23 more. But the Unabomber didn't really come into the public eye until 1995, because Kaczynski sent out what was dubbed the Unabomber Manifesto. It was a 35,000-word essay on the problems of modern society. And much like in this episode of Cowboy Bebop, where the Teddy Bomber sent a statement to big shots that was too long to read to fit in. That's a play on this, because Kaczynski did threaten a bunch of news outlets, like the New York Times, if they did not publish his work. 35, that's a novel. For those keeping count, that's technically a novel. But also the essay was how the Unabomber got caught, because Kaczynski's sister-in-law, Linda Patrick, read the manifesto and encouraged her husband to do so as well. And his brother David recognized the writing style and some of the ideas that that Ted expressed. And that information hit David going to the FBI in 1996, led to Kaczynski's arrest on April 3rd, 1996. The FBI arrested him in his cabin in Montana. He just lived in it like he was very isolationist, anti-technology, anti-capitalism. In his shack, he had a completed bomb, and he also had 40,000 pages, not words, pages of a journal. And he described like all of his crimes in details there. Now, I think because of the uniqueness of it, the manifesto, the sort of boiling over of news media in the 90s. I think this is post the O.J. Simpson arrest and trial, where it's, man, we heard about this on the news constantly. Like, he kind of became a joke. Today, just looking over it, I forgot that, like, SNL did a series of sketches on Ted Kaczynski. Will Ferrell played the Unabomber. And the gag is like they kind of make him out as like this very congenial, affable gentleman, but he still has like the crazy hair and beard. There's the very famous sketch artist rendition of the Unabomber.
Yes.
Which was just a dude in a hoodie and sunglasses and looked nothing like Ted Kaczynski.
Yes. Like, I'll be honest, like looking at that sketch and looking at they have a photo of him from like 1968 on the Wikipedia page. The jaw actually kind of matches up, but like, yeah, no, it's just a guy in a hoodie with big old aviators. Like, you can't really tell who the fuck this is supposed to be.
And SNL, I couldn't find it, but SNL also did a sketch about that sketch. It was Norm Macdonald as a sketch artist, and the gag was just like, he was bad. He was bad at art, and the only thing he could draw well were glasses and hats. And I think that's where the sort of flippant nature, especially with the rendition of this character, the Teddy Bomber, in the show comes from. Because you're taking something that happened in the United States and importing it over it to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And how are they getting it? They're getting it through the news. They're getting it through different media. So again, I think theorizing here, you have all these levels of media that they're interpreting this from, and it seems like the most omnipresent idea is that this is a joke character, because that's how the media were playing it. You know,
it's like,
here's this feared bomber. Well, he's like pooping in the woods in Montana in a shack. Just the media ate this up with a knife and fork. And I think, yeah, I think that's where that flippant nature of this subject matter comes from, is that filtering of this story through the media to Japan.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, his arrest in 1996 would have been like right in like the revving up of production on the show. So I can definitely see both sort of the like the very publicized nature of it, and all of the, like you said, all the sort of culture coming out of America about it definitely being a big just sort of a big grab bag for the production team to latch onto with the show.
And just in case it's not clear, fuck them.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's clear, fuck this guy. This guy sucks. You should make fun of him. But the interpretation is weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Here's a question for you.
All right.
You think Faye fucked Andy?
I think within the context of the show is that Andy is too full of himself.
Okay.
That it wouldn't even register because they have the moment. And I think it's expressed more in the sub. So they're toasting, and Andy, I forget what it is, but in the sub, he's like, he's trying to quote Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. And he's supposed to say, "Here's looking at you, kid." But instead he says, "Here's looking at," I believe, "the reflection of me." Mm-hmm. And you get that big shot of he's straight up checking himself out.
Okay.
In the reflection of Faye's eyes, which, Faye, you got some wet eyes. if that's the case.
Okay.
So I think no, because of that, because of the narcissism.
All right. Yeah, because I mean, she ends up back at his place, and then she doesn't come back till like the next day. So yeah, I was just curious.
That is true.
But I mean, she could have just like slept on the couch with the horse.
Oh, they couldn't have. Don't bring your horses inside.
Well, I mean, he's got like a. Wait, does he have an apartment or is that a spaceship?
I believe it was like a yacht, right? His space yacht.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Which, if the Bebop is to be any evidence, yachts can be spaceships.
Well, that's also more evidence for the, you know, Bizarro Spike argument. They're both in flying boats.
Yeah.
See, now you got my brain going, because she did stay the night there. I think
when she comes back, she's not in her big dress, which means she brought a set of clothes.
She's
carrying it over her shoulder.
I don't think that's that uncommon for a young woman.
That's
to carry a spare set of clothes.
I assume she has her spaceship. So
yeah, she's got a capsule.
Yeah. Yes, a Hoi Poi capsule.
Mm-hmm. So here's what y'all are going to listen to. I don't know if I'm going to keep this in. We'll see. This is me figuring out my biases in real time.
Okay.
So we'll see. I'll let Noah be the judge of whether this stays in or not. For some reason, and I think it's just because I watched the show in my late teens and I was a virgin at the time when I watched the show. In my brain, Faye's a virgin.
Okay.
I don't have any evidence for that. And I think it's just, it's residual teenage bullshit.
Okay.
Is what I will say.
Because I think
it, I can't believe we're thinking too hard about shit, I've already opened the door. Let's go through it. I think part of it is the anti-femme fatale thing, where it's like the presentation of like, well, she's this woman about town. She's this worldly woman, however you want to interpret that. And again, my dumb teenage brain is the reverse of that is, you know, virginity. Also anime. No one's had sex in anime ever.
Yeah. See, that's the thing that I was kind of thinking. Like, there's a very much a... At least in anime, there's sort of a cultural like idealization of virginity, and Faye plays up the you know, the sexuality of herself, but I don't know. Like, yeah, I'm trying to think of like any other moments in the series. Like, I think the only other, like, the closest we see to her having any sort of like romantic sort of a romantic sort of situation would be with Whitney Haggis Matsumoto.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's like they spent a lot of time together and were like effectively dating, or like, you know, as the description in my book says, it was a marriage swindler. So maybe
I'm not making a judgment call on Faye.
No.
Vis-a-vis virginity. It's just, it's me realizing that I have this idea in my head and I'm trying to figure out where that idea came from. And I think you're right about the anime influence of the idea of virginity in it. And it reminded me of, there is this interview that maybe we'll put in the show notes. I haven't read it in like almost a decade, but Brian Lee O'Malley, the creator of Scott Pilgrim, mm-hmm. I think he sat down and with like, he did like an interview, sort of a roundtable thing with these manga creators named Kentaro Takakuma and Koji Ahara. I guess they made a book called Even a Monkey Can Draw Manga.
Okay, yes, I'm aware of them and their works, but not that, but so, with the Super Mario Brothers, Super Mario World manga from Nintendo Power.
Oh, that rules.
Yes.
So in the interview, they talk to Brian Lee O'Malley about Scott Pilgrim, and they are blown away by the idea that Scott Pilgrim has had sex. Because they specifically talk about how, like, at least they're kind of older school. They're like, oh, no editor would allow that to happen. The end of a shonen manga would be the main character's confessing his love and then dying a virgin.
Yeah, okay. You think about any sort of, like, harem anime, like, ever, and it's always these sort of, like, ooh, girls, I don't want to touch a girl, but I want to be around a sort of like male protagonist. And then all the girls are like, they all want to be around this one boy, but they also don't want to, you know, everybody is like lusting after each other, but they don't actually ever want to do anything, which, I mean, you know, they're aimed at like certain age ranges, but still.
I mean, that's a very young man thing of, or a very heterosexual young man thing. Again, speaking anecdotally, where it's, I want to be around girls. I don't know why.
Yes.
But I want to be around them. I am so mad at anime right now for like, because it's a, why do I think that way? Because in my brain going over, I'm like, oh, Jet's fucked. Spike's fucked. You know what? I'm rewriting my brain.
Uh-huh.
Faye's had sex. Let's be real.
Yeah.
Let's not be dum-dums about it.
Yeah. I think you're right though. I don't think she fucked Andy.
Oh, and that for sure. No, she.
Yeah.
That guy's a tool.
Yeah. God. Okay.
I'm steaming about how I knew anime had changed my brain. I didn't realize it was this deep.
Anime, not even once. Also, when we were talking about how they all want to, you know, be around each other, but they don't want to do. All I could think of is fucking Heath Ledger Joker. I'm like a dog. I want to catch car, but when I get one, I don't know what I do with it.
God, turn to the Joker cast again.
God, no, not again. All right.
I'll bring this up now, but it's going to come back into movie recommendations, and I know you can add on to this, but the track that keeps repeating throughout the episode is called Go Go Cactus Man, the whistling, the mouth harp.
Yes.
And that is a pastiche, an homage to Ennio Morricone.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a very famous film composer, probably best known for his work on the spaghetti westerns of Sergio Leone, particularly the Dollars trilogy with Clint Eastwood as the man with no name. And they kind of even use it the same way that Morricone did, where there's usually some diegetic, look back in our past episodes for the meaning of that, uses of the music. So like in one movie, a character has, and I'm consciously withholding the name, one character has a harmonica. And so the score will start with our harmonica. We'll see that character play it, and then it'll go into the score of it. And we sort of get this in the episode as well with the whistling.
Yes.
I think mainly in the dinner party, you hear the whistling as he's coming up on a horse through the elevator.
It's, yeah, the dinner party and then like the final confrontation where Spike is confronting the Teddy Bomber, but also just like waiting around outside that fountain. He even like spots some random person whistling that like throws him off for a second.
Yeah, the fact that they've set it up so well that they can get a little misdirection out of it is wonderful. But yeah, they straight up ripped off Marconi.
His themes for the Dollar Trilogy are just so like burned in. Like, I don't think you can ever have like any sort of Western, even like comedic or not, like, well, typically comedically, but any sort of like Western scene without his themes coming into play, especially I feel like it's the one we're going to talk about, but yeah, the one that everybody knows.
Yeah. I mean, it's, even if you haven't seen a Sergio Leone film, you've heard wow, 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 wow.
Yeah, exactly. They just straight up, they just copy it wholesale. But did you know there's a version with lyrics?
Not until 15 minutes ago when he told me before we record it.
So there's a version of the song called Fascinating Horse Riding that was released with the CD box set. It came on the bonus 8-centimeter mini disc that also featured, what was it called? Wandering Cowboy, which is Ed singing over Tank. But it's Andy, it's Masashi Ibarra, the Japanese voice of Andy, singing over Go-Go Cactus Man. And the lyrics translated are thus: do you know who I am? Who said it? I don't know. Oh, who have I told? I don't know. My name is Andy, the man with the cowboy hat. You don't know about me? Oh, who did I hear it from? I've forgotten. I'm about to faint from that sensuality, because that's me in the mirror.
Ooh.
There are sleepless nights, lonely night, but only after taking a little nap, lonely day. I'll never forget you. By the way, who are you?
Wow.
Yeah. He's a sensual in there.
Yes.
It really got me. What a doofus.
Yeah. He's just the worst, and I love it.
There is a reality where him and Faye go off and Faye just lives a nice life of luxury.
Yeah. I think
if he didn't fuck it up.
That was something that I noticed, that when Ed brings up the information on Andy, brings up that he's a member of the YMCA, the Young Men's Cowboy Association. And
such a fucking dumb gag. I love it so much.
It's so good. Like, I think Spike even says he's Christian. It's like, no.
I don't know how to get into his business, but maybe.
But
agnostic, at least.
When they when they bring up that he's Andy Von Deonte, he's apparently like super rich. That's when like Faye perks up and talks about like how handsome he is.
Yeah, that's it's like, oh, do you think he's handsome? Maybe because he looks like a certain someone you know.
That too, yeah. So I think that definitely played into her like following him around, trying to get in good with him. And then she realized, oh man, this guy is a putz.
This dude, he sucks. He's got it. Look, if you meet a man who has his face on a can of soup, that's, you can't sneeze at soup money. You've got to consider it.
Yeah.
But it's just
weird triangle cans of soup.
I guess in space, there's less roll around. That makes sense. Fuck, they're so good, aren't they? They're so good at production design. That makes, right? That makes the most sense. It doesn't roll around.
Yeah. Oh, wait, okay.
Hold on a second. This show's deep, everyone.
I have a video for you to watch later about why soda cans are shaped the way they are.
Okay. Does it disprove what
my theory?
Well,
they talk about, like, hey, like, here's a square can, and here's why this wouldn't really work. But here's, like, a sphere can, and how why this wouldn't work. And here's why the cylinder is, like, the best possible of both worlds. It's really, really neat.
I know the cylinder is one of the strongest shapes as far for stacking.
Well, it's stacking, so but it's also part okay. of it. All right, I guess we're just going to talk about it.
Yeah. I'll talk about soda cans if you want.
So, like, a cylindrical soda can, it's the best of both worlds because it is a very good shape. There's very little unused space if you were to pack a bunch of cylindrical cans into, like, a box. But it also is very good at maintaining interior and exterior pressures against each other. So if you had, like, a square, like a cubicle can, there's plenty of points where there's, like, lots of areas of failure on it. Even though you can, they're more efficient for, like, shipping and storing, like, the corners and the edges are much more susceptible to damage, like, breaking open, that kind of thing. And obviously, a spherical can, you can't really hold it, and it's also not very good for shipping and all that. So that's, like, the basic ideas there.
They stopped too soon. They should have went with triangle.
It's triangle. Triangle's very strong shape. It's very good for bridges.
Yep, that's what Miss Frizzle taught me, at least.
Wahoo!
I had this thought just now.
Okay.
In the upcoming live-action Cowboy Bebop, it seems like, at least with the main storyline, they're trying to be faithful. Like, we got casting notice about Gren recently. So I'm thinking, how would the live action do this episode? Would they keep it as, here's a dude dressed as a cowboy?
I mean,
would they pick something else?
I mean, you kind of gotta, don't you? Like,
it's Space Cowboy.
Yeah, he's the literal Space Cowboy. Yeah, I feel like you would just have to get John Cho to dye his hair blonde and put on a cowboy outfit and play against himself.
I love
himself.
That.
I mean, to go off topic again, there's the whole casting declaration about Oscar Isaac playing Solid Snake in a Metal Gear Solid movie, which, if they're just going to adapt Metal Gear Solid 1, I guess he's also going to have to play Liquid Snake because they're twins.
Twins or clones?
Well, clones that are twins.
You know what the baller move is, though? You get Cal Penn to play Andy. That's 4D chess right there.
Never see it coming. All right, everybody listening, take note. They do Cowboy Funk as an episode. Cal Penn, he's playing Andy. We're calling it.
Again, like I said at the top, rewatching this for the first time, I'm like, yeah, this is still a fun episode. But the more we talk about it, just the more I'm getting and realizing that there's still a lot in this stew.
This son of a gun stew? This episode, for, like, the longest time, has been one of my favorites. Like, this and Mushroom Samba are, like, up until, like, rewatching it for the podcast, I think those two were probably, like, my top two episodes. And there's definitely been, I think, some shifting around this watch through, but, like, this episode's still really up there just because I feel like it's a lot of fun, even outside of, like, the horrible, like, terrorism that's going on.
Yeah.
There's just so much going on that, like, I think you get a lot of good stuff with, like, the entire cast. I think Spike and Andy squaring off is great. I like the Teddy Bomber for the most part because he's just, like, this put down every man space terrorist.
Yeah, they make a joke of him because he can never say the reason why he's doing it. He can never get his message across. And at the same time, at the end, he relents. He's like, well, I guess. It's like, oh, all this capitalism and all this colonization is a waste. And I'm like, well, what I did was a waste too.
Yeah.
It's like that, and like the cop, like a thing that would never happen. A cop put his hand on this terrorist's shoulder in a comforting way.
Yeah,
this is like truly sci-fi.
Yeah,
and again, to go back to last episode, there's a nice little True Grit reference when Andy is escaping the party on horseback. He racking his rifle. Yeah, rifle or shotgun? Rifle.
It is a lever action. Is it like a lever action, like grenade launcher?
Here's where I found like how my references got crossed. I'm like, oh, that's from True Grit, the original. Mm-hmm. That's what John Wayne pulls. Like, it's kind of badass. He's got the reins in his mouth. He's got a pistol in one hand, rifle in the other, and he like just spins the rifle around to recock it like a badass. And then Schwarzenegger does the same thing in Terminator 2: Judgment Day.
Yes, he does. Yeah, I've heard it called like a cowboy loop, because like a normal lever action just has like enough space for like your lower fingers, like everything except for like your index, which goes on the trigger. But if you make that loop larger, you can do that spin around. A former roommate of mine, when I used to live in North Carolina, bought what's called a mare's leg, which is a cut down lever action that had one of those, and we only attempted once or twice to try and do it because
was there a misfire?
No, there was no ammunition in it, but you still like getting that big sweep to do it, and hitting yourself in like the arm with a several pound metal instrument doesn't feel good. So they are really rad though.
I've never seen Full Metal Alchemist, but I was shooketh when you see Ayn walking in front of the frame with a wig on. Like, I know what this means.
Oh, man.
Again, for reference, the eye catch this episode, I think it's the first and only time we see this. And I've seen this graphic on a shirt a bunch. It's Cowboy Bebop, but it's done in like the Flash Gordon logo. Like the 80s movie logo. There's like a light. You see the swordfish in the middle and it's like yellow and red. And I honestly hate it. It's so, it's cool, but it's not as cool as just that plain text, man.
Yeah. So they've had to edit Jet's shirt a couple times.
Well, why would they do that?
So it's a costume party. That's like the middle act of the episode. And Jet goes as like a hippie and he wears a big old shirt that has a big old pot leaf on it. So can't do that on a children's TV show. So I think the first time around they just edited it out, and then on later versions they made it like a peace sign.
Maybe they did it on the earlier DVD releases too, because I feel like this might be the first time that I've seen it as the pot leaf.
Huh.
Again, could just be some Mandela effect, but
yeah. Did you look at the Big Shots credits at all?
No.
Okay. There's some very good like English names in there that you should go look at. But there's also like a couple of, like, I want to say some of these are like intentional jokes. The executive producer on Big Shots is Jack Washer, WASSHER. And the supervising producer is Dick Washer. And the head of the electronic laboratory is Max Hedrum. Yeah, I noticed those two like the last time I watched this episode and was very amused, especially at Dick Washer.
Okay, yeah, I'll have to. All right, I'll keep an eye out.
If that's an intentional pun by the production team, bravo. You get American humor very well.
That's but Dixon. There, I think the one thing we didn't mention is that at the end of the episode, Andy being kind of defeated by Spike through like a Rube Goldberg thing.
I kind of want to talk about that fight real quick.
All right, yeah, go for it.
I think this overall episode is animated like super, super well, and I think it really shows off at the end of the episode with the fight scene, just because there's something about it. It's very, very dynamic. There's a lot of sort of like big sweeping actions that go on. Like one thing that stuck with me before I even watched the episode this time around, but I always remember it, is the big like flying jump kick that Spike does, like across the rooftop. Like he just goes zipping across, mm-hmm. and then Andy manages to get him between the legs with an I-beam. But just the way that like that whole, the way the animation flows into like Spike running and then into the jump kick, it's very like sharp, this sort of sharp transition into that kick, and just the way that he just goes sailing and it's so smooth, and then bam, he gets hit. I just like, I really, really like the fight scene at the end of this episode. It just,
it's unnecessarily good.
Yes, it's like, it's just supposed to be Spike and Andy having it out finally, and they're just these two like idiot poofy haired goofballs that they just got to fight it out. Like that's the only way they're gonna get past any of this. And it's just so well animated. It's so fun. It's so dynamic. Like you were saying, it's like a weird Rube Goldberg kind of like finale. Like I can't praise this fight scene enough for just how how much fun it is.
And it's interesting to see Andy sort of being the calm one.
Uh-huh.
Because Spike's just, he's just filled with rage throughout this, which is uncommon. When he fights,
yeah, he's just absolutely seething. I think the only time we ever actually see him like that is when the one guy brings up Vicious on
in Jupiter Jazz.
Yeah, yeah, Jupiter Jazz.
They also try to steal from him.
Yes, that too. But just the fact that he mentions he mistakes him for Vicious, and he's like, "Oh, I'll show you Vicious," and just like, he gets like feral on them almost.
But a excellent fight scene, so good that it causes Andy to concede and to stop being a cowboy.
Uh-huh.
And at the end we see him riding off. He's now adopted a samurai persona.
Uh-huh.
Which is foreshadowed a little bit in the beginning when Spike's telling about his first encounter with Andy. Jet says, "No, if you made the character a samurai, I would have believed that, and you know, ha ha ha, we're joking."
Yes.
But he calls himself Musashi, who was actually a very famous samurai.
Yes, Miyamoto Musashi is a right bastard.
All right,
is what he is. He was a swordsman, a Ronin, and a lot of the times, his basic philosophy when it came to fighting was like, do whatever works, man. Like you're trying not to die. Just do whatever. Like, all this honor and humbling yourselves and all this other stuff. Nah, man. Don't worry about that. When you go fight this one dude on a beach, like your longtime rival, use a big-ass stick to beat him to death. Like, do what works. Throw sand, get nasty, fight like your life depends on it, because it does. Yeah, he was a founder of Niten Ichi Ryu, which is a two-sword style, like it literally means two-sword style. And he also wrote the Book of Five Rings, which has to do with his sort of sword style and philosophy. He bought his children, basically. He adopted his children, but by adopted, I mean, he just paid the family for them. It's, man.
Wait, a bunch of Citizen Kanes?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Yeah, Miyamoto Musashi has, we could do an entire podcast series about the wild shit this guy got up to. But yes, he's like the most legendary of Japanese swordsmen. And yeah, Andy choosing to call himself Musashi at the end of the episode is, you know, it's not a bad name to pick. There's actually a very, very good manga by Takahiko Inoue, who I believe, yes, he did the basketball series Slam Dunk, if you've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
A manga called Vagabond that is just all about Miyamoto Musashi. And it is unfinished. I don't think Inoue... I don't know if Inoue is ever actually going to finish it, because he's had some... He's made some very public statements about, like, not really sure how to finish the series, like, if he's going to be able to. It's, like, a hyper-detailed, very beautiful manga, and there's just, like, so much pressure on him that he's not sure if he's actually going to be able to finish it or not. But it's definitely worth checking out.
That's a little
pre-recommendation for you. Everybody looks good this episode. I really like at the end when Faye actually catches the Teddy Bomber, her outfit. Like, she looks good with the gloves and the jacket on, her normal outfit. Yeah, I think everybody looks good. Everybody's very well animated. Like, this episode is just outstanding, in my opinion. So
that couldn't have been fun for background artists. Or I guess not background artists, but... Hey, we're having a costume party. Fuck you.
Guess what Spike's costume is? It's just a mask. Fuck off.
It's there. We're done. Oh, he's in a big Teddy costume. Damn it.
That was pretty good. I like that they're like, oh, yeah, the teddy bear man. He's the bomber.
Come on, man.
Come on.
That is some supervillain stuff.
Yes, very much so.
Oh, where the penguins? Where is a penguin going to attack? An aquarium? There's only two in Gotham. We figured it out. It wasn't that hard. So I got some movie recommendations. I have two this week, which we haven't done in a while. One is... Genre-wise, I think it's appropriate. And the other one is more thematically appropriate. So the first one is the one I alluded to before, Once Upon a Time in the West from 1968. It is directed by Sergio Leone, who co-wrote it with Sergio Donati. And it's based on a story by some heavy hitters in the film world. Story is by Dario Argento. If you are a horror fan, you've probably heard that name. Just a bunch of giallo films, which I don't think Cowboy Bebop ever touches on that, so you'll never learn about it. No, it's an Italian thriller film, a slasher film, to be precise. So the story is also by Academy Award winner Bernardo Bertolucci. That Academy Award was for The Last Emperor. Also directed The Last Tango in Paris. And the movie stars Henry Fonda, who's probably best known for 12 Angry Men. He was actually cast against type in this movie. He plays the villain of the piece. Charles Bronson as someone seeking revenge against Fonda. Jason Robards as a bandit. And Claudia Cardinale as a newly widowed homesteader. The score, of course, by Ennio Morricone. And in 2009, this film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry. There's sort of two plots going on in this movie. One is a land battle over the construction of a railroad, and the other is Charles Bronson trying to get revenge on Henry Fonda's character. And Leone didn't really want to make this movie. In the Dollars trilogy, the ones that star Clint Eastwood... he did three of those. And after that, he's like, I'm done. I don't have anything else to say about Westerns. And then Paramount said, but what if we gave you a bunch of money and gave you Henry Fonda, which was apparently Leone's favorite actor. And he was like, okay, yes, I'll do it. And like, oh, thank God he did. Because this is one of the best Westerns out there. It is probably my favorite type, or like it takes place during my favorite time period for that Westerns can take place in. Is like the end of the West, where mm-hmm. civilization is coming back in and creeping in. And like the Wild Bunch deals with this, where it's the West was founded on these lawless men, these men who had to like pick up the gun to bring civilization to the West. But now that civilization is there, they are no longer needed, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just, it's beautiful, wonderful, slow-paced filmmaking. Please go watch it. It is like over 3 hours long. I'll go ahead and warn you on that one. But it's just beautiful. It's a wonderful Western. If you only see one Western in your life, you know, I don't think you can go wrong with this. Hard recommend. I also, but a movie that I have like more information on just because it came out later and I think is more thematically appropriate. You know, today's episode, Cowboy Funk, it's about a spaceman versus a cowboy, and another movie that is a spaceman versus a cowboy is Toy Story from 1995.
Oh, you got me good, Aaron. You got me.
The kid name is Andy. They named him Andy. Like, there's a clear connection.
Oh.
So I'm sure a lot of you know this. We'll just run down the basics real quick. It's Pixar's first feature film, and I believe it's in Guinness as the first feature-length computer animated movie ever made, which is insane to think about considering how much computer animation there is in the world. Like, all of it. All the animation.
Yeah.
It stars Tom Hanks as Woody, the cowboy toy, and Tim Allen as Buzz Lightyear, the space toy. It's just a cowboy toy gets jealous of a spaceman. You can't tell me that someone over at Sunrise would be in cheeky with the Andy cowboy thing.
You know, now that you mention it, like, I think you might be right. A cowboy named Andy. Oh, man.
I believe this was the highest. So in 1995, Toy Story was the second highest grossing movie of that year. Huh. So somehow Die Hard with a Vengeance beat it out.
March 23rd, 1996. Again. Huh.
What about 1996?
It released in Japan in March of 1996.
Okay.
Again, would have been in like pre-production, early production stages for the show. I've
always had this thought. I think
you might be right.
I want you to know I'm not trolling anyone. I genuinely think thematically it's similar. It's about a rivalry that. And the name Andy is prominent in both episodes. It's just, I am telling you, there is something here to this.
How do I write Shinichi no Watanabe? I want to get confirmation on this now. I want to, like, if we do nothing else with the show, I want this theory confirmed.
Well, while you're doing a white pages search for his personal address, if you haven't seen Toy Story, then I don't know, man. I'll lend you my Disney Plus subscription, I guess. So I thought it'd be fun to sort of learn some little known facts about Toy Story and sort of end on a goofy note, just like the episode. So here they are. So originally, Woody was not a cowboy toy, but a cowboy ventriloquist dummy. And thank God they changed it. Because no, yes. Thank you. I think a lot of people know that Joss Whedon was brought onto the script to rework it. And there's a version of the script that features Barbie more prominently. And she's kind of like in Joss Whedon fashion, she's like a Sarah Connor type character. She like rolls in to save Buzz and Woody from Sid's house. But Mattel said no. They didn't want to license the character. And the explanation they gave was that, well, Barbie is sort of supposed to be this blank slate that, mm-hmm. you know, people who have the toy, they can imbue whatever personality they want under her. And they didn't want to give her a set canonical type of personality.
Right.
But they changed their mind real quick after they saw those numbies.
Oh, yes. She's in the third one?
I believe she's not for long, but she's in the second one. I know the third one, she is very prominent.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they, Bo Peep sort of took her place.
Right, yeah.
And in the first movie, there's a very fun sequence of the little army men going to do reconnaissance at the birthday party. And the animators, to particularly Pete Doctor, to get the movements right, decided to nail wooden boards to their shoes. And so they spent an entire day walking around with boards nailed to their feet so they could get the movements right.
Mm.
And then the last thing that I thought was very, very, well, horrible. I'm sure it caused a lot of panic attacks. But this is in regards to Toy Story 2. So one line of code almost destroyed Toy Story 2. Writing in his book, Creativity Inc., Pixar co-founder Ed Catmull talked about that an incident in the winter of 1998, which was the year before the release of Toy Story 2. Somebody entered the command, and I'm sure I'm messing this up, /bin/rm-r-f asterisk. And this was entered in on the drives where the film's files were kept. And the purpose of this command is to delete everything in that location. Like, they talked about how, like, they were working and elements started disappearing. Like, Woody's hat disappeared, then his boots, and then Woody. On top of that, their backup also failed. But the supervising technical director, Galen Sussman, she had just had her second child, had been working from home, and had a backup of the entire movie there. I think they lost like a week of weeks of work, or one mm-hmm. week of work. So the moral of that story is maternity leave. Let people work from home.
Well,
well, those are yes. two different things, but
also backups on backups.
I felt less bad about my poor backing up practices again, working in media. Sometimes it just ain't in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
On smaller things, people forget. People are like, yes, we should shoot this regional commercial in 4K. Where are we going to store it? That's not my problem. I shot it. I don't have to worry about anything else. Anyway, I'm getting personal. And I'll stop. But yeah, backups. Toy Story's related. We'll if anyone knows how to get a hold of anyone that can answer this question.
Yes.
Please let us know. And go watch Once Upon a Time in the... Oh, I didn't... Hold on. The thing that we always have to do. So Once Upon a Time in the West, you can watch it on the Criterion channel. The Roku channel has it for free, and it's also on Amazon Prime. Also, the original title for Toy Story was You're a Toy, which is very bad.
You are a toy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Disney Plus. Actually, I think I canceled my Disney Plus because The Mandalorian's over and there's no point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, two. One I know you've definitely seen, and definitely check out Once Upon a Time in the West if you like. If you have a middling interest in Westerns, you'll dig it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the few Leone films that I have not actually seen. So I will definitely have to actually sit down and watch that sometime soon.
See, here's a little secret. Here's the dirty little secret. I haven't seen any of the Dollar Trilogy.
Really? All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Once Upon a Time in the West was a film school film, so I've seen it a bunch.
Huh.
But it's different from the Dollar Trilogy. It's
right,
a little
right.
more serious, and it's yeah, way slower paced, more Kurosawa influence. Oh yeah, Leone loved Kurosawa.
Yes. And
he straight up copied Yojimbo for the first for A Fistful of Dollars.
Yes. Very much so. Thank you very much for joining us this week. Again, this episode, I absolutely love it. And we'd like to hear how much you love the show, both Cowboy Bebop and us, hopefully, if you're listening to this. And you can let us know that by rating and reviewing us on whatever podcast service you happen to be using. That helps us climb the charts, get more attention, so more people can listen to it. And, you know, also share it with friends. Just say, hey, you like anime. Want to hear these two knuckleheads get really into some personal shit while talking about anime?
Realize that they've been infected with a brain virus since yeah. the 90s.
And you can also let us know how we're doing by emailing us. You can email us at thinkingtoohardpod@gmail.com. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter @thinkinganime. Aaron, what are you up to?
Nothing. Why? You wanna hang out after this?
Take a drive. I would love to.
God, I'd fucking love to too. But instead of that, you can find me on I'm on Twitter mainly at Aaron J. Shelton. That's where I'm hanging out online. I'm sure I'll talk about One Piece since I'm starting to read that from the beginning.
Yes.
You can also listen to me talk and joke about Dragon Ball on Kame House Party, my other podcast that I host with Vince White. We just did our holiday special, which is, I mean, it won't be the holidays once you listen to this, but still you can go back and do it. We did a semi-improvised version of the Santa Claus, but with the Jerobia Corn. And then every Thursday night, I am streaming on Twitch, twitch.tv/Kame House Party, a variety of games and a variety of fun. And that is, those are the places you may find me at.
Cool. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kamen Otaku. That's KamenOtaku. I'm also streaming now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So you can follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/Kamenotaku, KamenOtaku. I'm doing kind of a mix of stuff. I'm playing some Blasphemous, which is you want to talk about symbolism. it is a Castlevania Dark Souls, 2D Dark Souls kind of game that is very much inspired by Spanish Catholicism. So it's got a look. And also doing some like miniature crafting and painting streams as well. So tune in for those. Follow me on there if you would, please. I'd greatly appreciate it. And then you can also check me out on a couple other podcasts for tabletop role-playing games, like The Role-Playing Exchange, the Technical Difficulties Gaming Podcast, Role-Playing Public Radio, and on Saturday, which...
Oh, is it starting?
Yes, on Saturday the 2nd. Yes, Saturday, January 2nd. Every Saturday after that, I will be on the Best Pal Brigade Twitch stream. We'll be playing a mecha themed 4th edition D&D game. So go check that out.
Wow, that is niche as hell.
It's super niche, but it's gonna be fun. So join us in 2 weeks, correct? We're back onto 2 weeks. Join us in 2 weeks for not episode 23, but Cowboy Bebop the movie, aka Cowboy Bebop knocking on heaven's door.
We're pulling a sneaky on you.
We're doing this in like the real timeline. But until then, I've been Noah Carton,
and I've been Aaron J. Shelton,
and we've been thinking too hard.